What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
On the eve of the national holiday known as Thanksgiving, 29-year-old Ramnula Lankawal shot and killed National Guardsman 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom and wounded 24-year-old Andrew Wolf, who remains in critical condition. Lankawal, 29, has been charged with first-degree murder. He was shot by another National Guard member during the incident and is also hospitalized. Since that time, the conversation that has emerged from the White House has not been about mental health or the impact of war. It has been continued anti-immigrant rhetoric that does nothing to address the national tragedy of last week or the ongoing crisis of mental health and gun violence in this country. Joining us to discuss is Jamal Abdi, the president of the National Iranian American Council. Good morning, Jamal.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us, Jamal. I'll get to the Trump administration's problematic response shortly, but I think context is important. As I was talking about in my introduction, what we know about Lankawal is that he was engaged in war activities and that he had been struggling with mental health for quite some time, and that social service agencies in D.C. knew this, yes?
Yeah, that's right. It's a sad portrait of what happened once he got here. It seemed like he was really struggling with a lot of issues and did not have any outlets for support. And this is somebody who, as you mentioned, served in the CIA, essentially a death squad in Afghanistan, was fully vetted by the Trump administration and granted asylum, vetted by Biden and then granted asylum under Trump. And yeah, it's a very sad story of once he got here, how he just did not have any support. And it seems like there were a lot of red flags that were just sort of ignored until it culminated in this horrific incident.
Yeah, I wish I could find the quote, or I wish I had cut and pasted it, but there was a quote from someone at one of the social service agency tasked with supporting him and others like him, but talked about how unwelcoming, how unable he was to adapt to basically feeling like this country had rejected him once he got here. Now I want to move into the Trump administration's response to this tragedy, which has been to further criminalize immigrants, and particularly from the 19 countries that he targeted in his first administration. One of the things that they've put forth is rigorous reexamination of every green card. What does that mean?
That means people who are here in the country, who have made their lives here and have permanent residence, who, I mean, especially in this era where there are travel bans and students being picked up because their student visa has some questions about it, but they think they're here illegally. There's so much uncertainty, but the one thing that does grant some level of certainty is having a green card, having permanent residence, going through that process and you know, making this your home. And so they're talking about going back and looking at those green card applications and essentially reevaluating them. And if it's anything like what has happened with visas, you know, there have been so many cases that we've dealt with and others have worked on of people who had no idea that their visa had suddenly been revoked. It had just quietly happened, and then they get picked up at an airport, and the visa's revoked, you know, who knows why, you know, some, you know, a minor crime that was committed, you know, a decade ago, or like I said, you know, it had lapsed and their university had said, well, we're working on renewing it, you're fine, you're still valid. And then they just get picked up and thrown into a detention center by ICE. So that's what's happening with visa holders. Now they're talking about actually going after green card holders, which is kind of a new level. And it reminds me of during the first Trump administration, you know, the first week he rolled out the travel ban or the Muslim ban. And it was this policy that hadn't really been articulated what it actually meant. And so some green card holders were being affected. And even the Trump administration at the time sort of realized, oh, this is crossing a line we can't really cross. These are permanent residents. And so they announced, well, this is not a policy that is actually going to apply to green card holders. Now it's sort of, you know, no holds barred. And even a green card holder, a legal permanent resident, now has to live with this uncertainty as, you know, somebody who calls America home, this uncertainty about, am I going to get rounded up? Am I going to find out that my green card was suddenly stripped from me?
This just feels like a good time to remind my listeners about Sami Hamdi, who is the pro-Palestinian British reporter, or UK-based reporter that was picked up here in the Bay Area. And that exact thing happened. He was on a work visa. Next thing you know, it was revoked and he was incarcerated. Are there metrics, Jamal, for this reexamination? Like, is there a list that agents are... You're smiling and I am asking it in that vein. Is there like a list where it's like, oh, well, this, you know, we check this box, we don't check this box. Like, is there a process? Or is this left up to human whatever?
Yeah, I mean, just like the case you mentioned, it was so clearly political. It was so clearly about something that had been said that was, you know, ruffling the feathers of the Trump administration on, you know, Israel policy. So in this case, I don't think we know yet how they're going to go about reexamining green card holders, you know, eligibility. What we do know is they want to make country-specific restrictions. So they're essentially saying, we can now look at what country you came from and decide that because that is a problematic country, that is now a factor for stripping your green card away. And they had already, before this happened, I mean, they're sort of taking advantage of this horrific incident to put forth these policies that were already in the works. So before this happened, just a couple of weeks ago, the Trump administration announced that they were going to start using country-specific factors. So essentially, are you on the list of countries that have been banned? There's 19 countries on this list. And for no other reason other than you are from this country, they were now going to say, we're not going to allow a visa holder to get a green card if they're from one of those countries. Or the person who is evaluating it can use that as a factor to deny a green card for those people. Now they're saying, you already have a green card. We're going to look at you if you are from one of these 19 countries and assume that is you're starting out, you know, behind. You're starting out with a black mark on your record because you're from one of those countries. Where it goes from there and how they're actually, you know, are they looking at like what they've done with visas, looking at, you know, past misdemeanor crimes, or are they going to be looking at political expression and social media? I don't think we actually know that yet. And this is one of the reasons, you know, like my organization is suing ICE to just turn over information about basic stuff like for us, you know, Iranian American organization, how many Iranians are detained by ICE right now? We don't even have a number. What is happening once they're going into detention? And then there was actually, there's these deportations happening. So what was it, a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, there were a bunch of Iranians who were here in this country, mostly, you know, completely legally, many with no criminal record or anything like that, some of whom were actually political dissidents who were here with active asylum cases, who were rounded up and put on a plane and sent back to Iran. And in many cases, faced persecution inside of Iran, had really credible reasons for being here in the United States because of their political views that were that were targeted inside of Iran, or because they were a religious minority or something like that. They were all put on this plane, and we have no information about the process there, and how many, you know, were put in this process. How was this actually undertaken? So all of this is happening with just extreme lack of transparency.
So you sort of segued to where I want to go next. I'm looking at the picture behind you, every member and organizer, which I love. As organizers, right, we look at political conditions, we look at landscapes, we try to pre-plan so that we're not just in the reactionary, that we're building some sort of offense as a defense of our community members or to change the material conditions. To your point, and it's around this issue, it's around almost all of the issues, all of the communities are under attack in various ways by the Trump administration. We just don't know. We don't know what's coming, right? We can't look at the law because the law apparently doesn't matter right now. How do you as an organization plan, operate, build your campaign strategy in such uncertain political conditions?
That's a great question. I think this issue in particular is really vexing. I mean, everything right now is on fire, but this issue in particular, because there is clearly... you know, there's legal recourse, there's, you know, trying to work through Congress, through oversight there. And a lot of those tools up until now have not really been at our disposal. You know, in Congress, maybe we can get some symbolic, you know, legislation or a letter to try to bring attention to this, but we can't actually necessarily enforce anything. In the media, there's just this deluge of these cases. And so whereas a few years ago, something really bad happens and it's sort of big news, you know, the travel ban in Trump's first week in 2017. And now it's just people have become numb to it. There's so much happening. And so I think for us, we have ended up focusing, it's kind of, you know, playing defense, taking care of people. So trying to focus on what resources can we just ensure are there for people dealing with this right now in the here and now. So what kind of, you know, legal trainings can we provide? What kind of casework support can we provide to somebody who has been targeted so that they are connected to resources they need or legal support or things like that? So there's a lot of that. But as far as organizing and trying to change the policy, I mean, I think we're really thinking about how is the pendulum sort of swinging where this is not de rigueur anymore and people are starting to, first of all, the public is starting to say, okay, whereas many people supported Trump's immigration talk during the election, which was pretty unfathomable to me that people would support ICE agents doing raids on people's houses and in our communities and things like that. It's not all come true. And so people are starting to turn against it. And then on the Hill and in Congress, you're starting to see, at least from some quarters, some backbone starting to shape up. And so we're kind of looking at it like we did with the last Trump administration, where once we can finally build up sort of the public narrative around this and, you know, get people on the same page as far as opposing these policies, then we can actually push for legislation or oversight hearings that actually have teeth. And those oversight hearings in the previous Trump administration, like on the travel ban, actually spurred the administration to do what it said it was going to do, at least. So in that case, actually granting waivers that they had to do to comply with the Supreme Court. So that congressional oversight does have a impact on the way the policy is being carried out. But ultimately, I think what this moment is this is a moment of extreme pain that is actually providing leverage for advocates and organizers to fix the problem once we actually have the power to do so. So, what happened under the Biden administration and under the Congress after Trump left was they sort of said, okay, this is an aberration and we don't actually need to put any concrete sort of guardrails in place to prevent a future president from doing things like this. We're just going to continue to sort of allow immigration enforcement and going to war and things like that to be kind of this gentleman's agreement that we haven't really figured out how to truly have legal restrictions in place if somebody like Trump comes along. And so they blew it. They didn't put anything in place. There's still, Trump still has total authority to ban people. He's doing all this stuff with the courts, which, you know, we're going to see, is there actually going to be consequence? But I think the key is, I mean, I'm just looking a lot to the midterms and when there's potentially a change in power where you could actually have Congress start to pass some laws that actually truly guard against this and not what we have now, which are laws that have a lot of loopholes that have been sort of exploited in so many ways by the administration. Those need to be closed. Those need to be fixed because now we've had not just one, but two examples of how this is being abused. And so now it's time to wake up and actually fix it.
It hit me in the gut in a particular kind of way when you said, wait till there's a change in power. I mean, I get it. I look at the landscape, right? We're all sort of struggling to figure out what tools are available to us at this moment. I mean, there's even question, you know, one of the, I think, smartest questions posed in some of the rooms at the beginning of his second term was what tools are still available to us now? Are the courts still available to us now? What organizing strategies still make sense? What can we do to mitigate harm? This thought of waiting. One of the things that I said when the headlines, you know, when he rolled out all of those horrific proclamations was, we're all reacting to the headlines right now and they're horrible. Like they're really awful. We need to be thinking about what the headlines actually mean. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. Because then we'll be dealing with the actual devastation of what those policies mean. And that, I guess, is what I'm sitting with, is that by the time there's a significant shift in power, how bad will it have gotten and how much rebuilding are we going to have to do?
Yeah, and how many, I mean, just the micro level, how many people's lives have been absolutely destroyed? How many families have been destroyed? And I think, I mean, it's not waiting. Like, politicians don't see the light till they feel the heat. So it is still a matter of bringing this to bear. I mean, what we're, we have chapters around the country making sure lawmakers are hearing from us and are understanding. Like, they're, a lot of Republicans are making this calculation of at what point could I potentially break from Trump on this stuff? At what point is this so unpopular that I actually can't continue to run defense for this guy? And so I think for now, as we are building up towards the midterms, and I think a lot of organizing needs to happen there too, not just to, elect good candidates, but to make sure that the people who do get elected are actually going to do something this time. But for now, it is also just making sure that nobody in power is actually sitting comfortably while this is happening. Every time something like this happens, lawmakers need to be hearing from their constituents and from their districts and, in the local papers and things like that, how unpopular this is. And who knows, maybe they will see the light and maybe they will be a part of actually reforming things and having real democratic reform. But if they don't, then yeah, we're going to have to wait until November and elect them out so that there's actually formal tools of power to be able to use to claw some of this stuff back. But I think ultimately what you're saying, like what's most important is this can't just be the norm. This can't just be something where we get so numb to it, which is what I think happened last time. It wasn't that it was the norm. It was just that, okay, the Trump was a blip. Now we can go back to our lives and not actually do anything to preempt this from happening again. We have to make sure that this time, when candidates are running on the notion of democratic reform and putting in place real guardrails against autocracy and dictatorship, that they actually do those things. And so we have to not relent right now and make sure that the people who are in power are hearing from us so that maybe they change their minds and listen to their constituents. And we have to not relent then when there is a change in power and make sure that just because now there's a sort of an opposition government in place or opposition in Congress in place, that they're still hearing from us that we want real action. We're not just going to ride this out and hope that the next guy is better than Trump is.
And not for nothing, but the previous administration wasn't all that great on immigration either. I mean, Biden built more detention centers for immigrants than even his predecessor, Obama, has. Obama was the deporter in chief. So some of this is also about the left not getting complacent with status quo, because life for immigrants, undocumented people, black folks, brown folks, poor folks, none of that was great ever. It's just really, really, really bad now.
I just look at these as like these are leverage points, and if we I sort of feel a responsibility for all the suffering that is happening, that is leverage to then be to use to change things. And I agree, like during Biden, people got complacent. By the time the presidential race started up, Biden and then Harris were sounding like Trump on immigration, and everybody said that's fine. There was no backlash. They calculated that this is actually acceptable. And I think we just can't allow people to unlearn what has happened in this new phase and how scary and horrible and how much, how many lives have been ruined by this. Now we have a second chance. Now we're getting stress tested again, and we can't relent this time.
Jamal, we know that policies that happen on the Hill or inside of the halls of power impact what happens on the ground, i.e. public sentiment. So a thread that I've been trying to tug is, what is the reality for Arab folks, regardless of their country of origin, in terms of increased visibility and impact of racism and vigilante violence?
Gosh, I mean, there's I'm trying to think if there has been a spike. I mean, there's clearly been documented, examples of a spike in sort of violence against certain communities and the way that the president and others talk about immigrant communities or Middle Eastern communities. I know that that is out there. As far as my vantage point, overwhelmingly what I'm hearing is just it's actually not people who are being inspired by racist rhetoric and doing this, targeting communities themselves, it's actually the government that is doing it. It's actually the ICE agents, the masked ICE agents. So I don't know. Maybe it's everybody who otherwise would have been inspired to do something horrible to somebody because of the racist rhetoric is now getting a $50,000 bonus and doing it on behalf of the federal government. But I think it's a, you know, it's just, it's a climate of just uncertainty and fear. But I think a lot of that fear and uncertainty, it actually is not necessarily now from the communities. It is from the government itself.
Well, Abdi, what have I not asked you that you feel like people need to know? And is there a call to action you'd like to share with my listeners?
I mean, you know, we didn't touch on it, but you mentioned it. Just, you know, this is this last case with the National Guard, the horrible shooting and killing of at least one of the National Guardsmen. This is a war that we fought abroad, which at the time, you know, the motto from the Bush administration at the time was, we're going to fight the terrorists there, so we don't have to fight them here. Well, what we've actually done is terrorize communities there, and the violence always comes home. And so it's not just we're talking about immigration and the need to reform all of these processes and be more humane, but we also need to talk about like foreign policy and war policy and all of the death and destruction that we foster through our war machine. It is going to come home to roost. And so I think just there needs to be a total evaluation of that. As far as calls to action, I guess for right now, you know, we just launched a congressional scorecard where we're evaluating every member of Congress based on where they are on issues like Israel-Gaza, immigration, ICE, war with Iran. So that's on our website. It's nyackcouncil.org. And I just encourage people, now is the time to really know where your member of Congress stands and let them know you know where they stand, because we're going to hold them accountable. And this tool that we developed, we hope, is a way to organize people, especially going into 2026, so that we can hold our members of Congress accountable. And I hope everybody who wants to checks that out and then either signs up with an organization that they know and have worked with, or they can sign up with us, whoever it is. But now is the time. You got to be a part of something that is organizing to hold our elected officials accountable and take back power.
Hey, that's how I end my public speeches. You got to get engaged, find what makes your heart sing and do that. Jamal Abdi, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.